are listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. Stay tuned now for the Hour of the Time with yours truly, William Cooper.
You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Sorry, girls. You want to start over?
Yeah. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Hi, Dad.
That's Anna, folks. Sorry about that. This crazy CD machine took off on its own once again. Hi, Chihuahua. I have a new one downstairs, and tomorrow it will be ceremoniously switched. And this one will probably go to Pooh's room. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight is going to be a very important and a very revealing broadcast. As you know, I am the director of the Intelligence Service and the KAGI News Service, which together is the largest and most successful civilian intelligence gathering organization in the entire world. We have been investigating the bombing of the Alfred P. Mira Federal Building in Oklahoma City since the event happened, and we have taken our investigation back to several years before the explosion actually occurred. And what you're going to hear tonight are some of the results of our investigation, which have not ever been revealed to the public from any source. And we're going to go as long as it takes, which means this broadcast may be longer than an hour. If so, we will not preempt Quest for Help with Michael Cottingham. It will follow the Hour of the Time whenever we finish with what we have to tell to the American people. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to prepare yourself with pen and paper. Get ready to hear some astounding revelations. And those of you who have already purchased Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore, Major Michelle Marie Moore of the Intelligence Service of the Second Continental Army of the Republic Militia, have already a glimpse, just a glimpse, ladies and gentlemen, into the truth of what really happened on April the 19th, 1995, why it happened, and who brought it about. Tonight, you're going to have some revelations that are going to help clarify some of these things in your mind. And if you've never heard any of this before, stand by to be absolutely and totally shocked to your very core. Thank you.
as she came rising through the dark. No moon to keep her arm or break, and no man to get her through this darkness. There is smoky night. The kind of work I had before was a wedding, something white to wear upon was a You see, I've watched you riding almost every single day. And there's something in there that just yearns to win. Such a very cold, such a very lonesome heroine.
When the wind blows.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to give you a little background as to what you're going to hear tonight. And I'm going to tell you some of the things that we know to date from the investigations that we have been conducting all over the United States and in Europe. We know, number one, that Timothy McVeigh was an extremely patriotic young man. We know from his writings and his letters that he was not a racist, as he is being portrayed by some people who have a specific interest in portraying him as such. We know that Timothy McVeigh did some things in the Gulf War that brought the attention of his commanding officer and even the field commander, and he was decorated. He was also brought in to serve on the personal security team of General Norman Schwarzkopf. We know that Timothy McVeigh, when he rotated back to the United States, applied to become a member of the United States Army Special Forces. Now, here's where things begin to happen, ladies and gentlemen. He was a young man in excellent physical condition who had distinguished himself on the battlefield. He was appointed to the personal security team of General Norman Schwarzkopf. He was in excellent physical and mental condition. He was described by everyone who knew him as a soldier's soldier. He excelled in all of his courses and all of his training activities. Everyone who knew him said that he was an outstanding soldier. People that we interviewed said that if Timothy McVeigh had stayed in the United States Army, he would have gone far. Now, what that means in their language, I don't particularly know, but in the Navy it would have meant there would have been no obstacle to promotion or assignment to sensitive or difficult duties, if you will. We know that Timothy McVeigh's application for Special Forces training was approved. We know that he went to Fort Benning, Georgia, where he entered into, I guess, according to what the United States Army says, was a pre-training evaluation. And according to the United States Army, Timothy McVeigh flunked this test, whatever kind of test that it happened to be, and was not accepted into Special Forces training. I find this extremely difficult to believe, ladies and gentlemen, unless someone was trying to turn this young man in a specific direction. It is highly probable, and indications are, that Timothy McVeigh was recruited by an intelligence organization, most probably the Central Intelligence Agency, for some specific task. Timothy McVeigh left the United States Army. When he left the United States Army with an honorable discharge, he began to tell people strange stories. He began to behave in a different way than he had ever behaved before in his life. He stated that he had been implanted by the United States Army with a microchip in his buttock, in the gluteus maximus area of his body. He said that the United States Army could follow him wherever he went and knew exactly what he was doing and wanted him to do what he was doing. There are so many witnesses that have heard Timothy McVeigh relate this story, ladies and gentlemen, that there is no doubt that Timothy McVeigh told it, and there is no doubt from those who heard it that he believed it. He then began to associate with people that he would not have associated in previous years. He began to take on what might be termed as an anti-establishment mentality. And he made no bones about communicating this to friends, acquaintances, family members. Nevertheless, whenever he wrote letters in response to political articles or articles to which he agreed or disagreed with in newspapers, it is clear that Timothy McVeigh was no racist. He did not believe in these things. How he came to be associated with people who do is very strange, and to this day there is absolutely no explanation for it, unless Timothy McVeigh completely changed his whole mental outlook. And there is no evidence that he has ever done that, not even now, that he or someone who claims to be him is in prison, having been arrested and accused of perpetrating the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. We know that Timothy McVeigh and a man known as John Doe No. 2 and several other people who called themselves Timothy McVeigh and looked exactly like Timothy McVeigh and John Doe No. 2 lookalikes toured this country and visited known patriot and militia leaders attempting to recruit them to help them in some unknown mission, but in each incident of this contact, they always told these people, watch Oklahoma City. And in the second volume of the series and our ongoing investigation called Oklahoma City, the Aftermath, we will attempt to reveal much more about these trips and contacts with known patriot militia leaders and some of the things that were communicated and relayed, and some of the results of these meetings, but we can't really do that right now. We know, ladies and gentlemen, that there was no secret about this. We also know that Timothy McVeigh and this John Doe No. 2, or Timothy McVeigh lookalikes and John Doe No. 2 lookalikes, were under surveillance for at least 9 months to 2 years previous to the bombing in Oklahoma City. We know that they were under surveillance by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We also know, ladies and gentlemen, that every single thing they did was recorded, that all of these law enforcement agencies and the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith had photographs of these people everywhere they went throughout the country. We know that there was no attempt to stop anything that these people had planned to do. And according to our investigation, it appears that Timothy McVeigh, John Doe number 2, and others were acting on instructions from higher authority, most probably believing that they were doing a service for their country, not knowing that they were to be made patsies, and at the highest level in this chain of command, it was always intended that the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building be blown up and that the maximum death toll be inflicted in order to promote a political agenda. And this is where we pick up with our special guest tonight, Michelle Marie Moore, who is the author of Oklahoma City Day One. She was, at the time of the explosion, the station chief in Oklahoma City, Kansas, Missouri, and Arkansas. Not too long ago in August, she was relieved of her command and placed on indefinite leave in order to put the loose ends of this investigation together and work on Oklahoma City, the aftermath, and the third volume, which will follow. Welcome to the Hour of the Time.
Good evening, Bill.
Is there anything you want to add to my preface to tonight's broadcast?
Only that it does make sense that McVeigh knew he was being recruited for a specific purpose, because when he was arrested, they asked him if he knew why he was being arrested, and he said, "Well, it must be about that Oklahoma thing."
Mm-hmm.
And that would make sense if he never thought that he was going to be arrested and then ended up being arrested.
Yes. We also know that he made the statement to many people that the United States Army knew where he was all the time.
Right.
And that they wanted him to do what he was doing. He also made the statement on several different occasions that he had many friends in the military.
Yes.
And we have all of that documented.
Yes.
Okay, let's begin then, wherever you want to begin, and let's go through everything that we've got that we have not yet disclosed to the public, including some of the things that you may not have here with you tonight. Did you want to get into this right away?
Not right away.
Okay.
Let's talk about our video evidence first.
Okay.
Okay, have you got a good reading on me? Am I loud enough?
Yes.
Okay.
You're fine.
Okay. we've been reviewing videotapes made at the scene. And recently, there has been a lot of publicity given to 5 police officers who are being given this National Medal of Commendation for heroic actions in response to their performance at the Mura Building bomb site. And most of you who received the Parade magazine and the Sunday newspaper saw this article. It was about 2 Sundays ago. And there are 2 very glaring falsehoods in that article, which we can now prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that they are falsehoods. One of them we could prove before. Now we have the other one solidly and on videotape. The first was the story about Officer Chicken Dance and Alex McCauley, DEA agent, being trapped in the elevator fell, many stories, they forced their way out, got out of the building, and then went back to help with the rescuers. We were able to confirm that none of the elevators fell. I know we've talked about this before. We now have located witnesses who saw Alex McCauley outside the building before the bombing even occurred. And this is causing great consternation on the part of Officer Chicken Dance, and we're not sure what action he intends to take in response to the public revelation of the lie that he told. We don't know who told him to tell that lie, but it's undergoing some revision. And the other thing that we discovered was the presence of Luke Franey.
Well, wait a minute. Agent McCauley was from where?
DEA.
Okay. So this was obviously an attempt to point to somebody and say, well, you're wrong. We did have people in the building, and we did have people injured. But in fact, they were not in the building. They were not in the elevator. The elevator did not fall as they have claimed that it did, and we have absolute proof of that, no doubt whatsoever. And now we have witnesses that saw
McCauley
outside the building before the bombing even took place. Now you're going to go into
Mr. Franey. Mr. Franey was in charge of the BATF in the Murrow Building, and it was really critical that some of these offices had some people in the building at the time of the bombing, because it looked very strange that
all of these guys were gone.
Right, all these guys were gone. Excuse me. Well, Luke Franey's story was that the bomb went off. He was in the building. He was knocked unconscious. He was trapped under debris for over an hour, came to consciousness, struggled and fought his way out of the debris, and then, using his martial arts skills, karate chopped his way through three walls to get out of the building, miraculously escaped, and then went back in to heroically rescue other people. And the result of this was that he had a broken hand. At least he showed up the second day with his hand in a cast. However, we have looked at and positively identified, in close-up, actually, Luke Franey in front of the Water Resources Board building, shaking hands with the alleged broken hand while holding a water jug in the other hand, looking perfectly healthy, clean, unscratched, unlacerated, no problems with him.
Not even any dust.
No, not even any dust. He was a very clean-looking guy in front of the building between 9:30 and 10 o'clock in the morning. And at this time, he was supposed to still be unconscious and buried under debris.
Yes. And how do we know this?
Well, he's right there in the videotape.
But how do we know the time frame?
The time frame. Well, the cranes that they brought in downtown to do heavy lifting and the removal of big chunks of concrete and lifting of floors and so forth were logged in. Anybody that came in was logged in, and the cranes were logged in as arriving inside the perimeter at 10:03, and it was a little while after they were logged in that they were actually set up. But there are absolutely no cranes at all in front of the building when Luke Franey is videotaped, and
or anywhere in the range of the video camera, which covers the whole area during
It was videotaping all over downtown in the immediate vicinity of the building and the blocks surrounding, and none of the cranes had arrived yet. It was still just fire department ladders in front of the building.
You cannot even see cranes blocks away.
No, there were no cranes at all in
Not even in sight, which really puts it probably closer to 9:30 than 10 o'clock.
Possibly so.
Because if the cranes were en route and were anywhere within sight, because the video camera shoots right straight down the streets, there are no cranes in sight anywhere. These are not little cranes. These are cranes that stick up way up in the air.
Well, the cranes that were up there were taller than the building was tall. And so they were probably 120, 130-foot high cranes.
So this is a very important piece of evidence that that proves that Luke Franey is a liar, was not knocked unconscious, trapped in the building,
Well, he didn't karate chop his way through any walls.
Of course not. And was, in fact, standing on the street, shaking hands and talking and laughing. Looked like he had just stepped out of the shower and put on a fresh set of clean clothes.
Right. But the very next day, he showed up on the bomb site with his right hand in a big, heavy cast and looking all kind of worn out and acting like he was tired and dragged out and everything because he'd hurt himself so badly escaping from the debris. And there's very few people who believe that, but that's the story that he's telling, and he's told it so often, and it's been repeated by officials to the point that now it's appearing in national newspapers, and these guys are getting medals for doing their rescue work.
Yes, all based upon lies. Now, let's go back even before the bombing, and let's talk about what happened during that night. We have witnesses, not one witness, not two witnesses, but several witnesses that did see people inside the Mura Federal Building with flashlights moving from room to room and floor to floor.
Right, from the east end of the building to the west end of the building at the third and fourth floor level, stopping and spending a lot of time by the elevator shaft wearing coveralls.
And the elevator shafts are where the canisters of fulminate of mercury were found with the detonators in them.
Right.
And that morning, we know that the bomb squad was there as early as 6 a.m. We know that there were federal agents, BATF agents, and Oklahoma City police at the scene that morning from 6 a.m. onward. We know that people coming to and from by the federal building and the courthouse saw the bomb squad and saw these FBI and ATF agents. We know that at one point during the morning before the bombing, a surveillance camera actually filmed two FBI agents in their ninja suits with automatic weapons or assault rifles, expressing consternation that the bomb truck had not arrived yet.
Right. This was a surveillance videotape that was made in front of the YMCA building, and part of the contents of that tape were two FBI agents in their full riot gear, body armor, and the helmets and the whole works with their rifles, griping and complaining about how the truck was late, and they were tired of waiting for it to arrive. And it was a copy of this videotape that Officer Terrence Yeakey had in his possession at the time that he was murdered.
And we'll get into that full exposition in a little bit. Let's talk about some of the people who saw these bomb squad personnel and the bomb squad truck and the BATF and FBI in front of the building that morning before the bomb went off, which proves absolutely that they knew that it was going to happen and that they were there, either waiting for it to happen or waiting to perform what they believed on their lowest level to be a sting operation, not understanding that they were all being sucked in. Let's talk about some of the people, what they saw, and you don't have to name them. They'll be named in the book if you don't want to.
You mean the witnesses?
The witnesses. And tell the listening audience what they saw and what they heard.
Well, there were a large number of BATF and FBI agents on the scene in front of the building prior to the bombing, and they had been there for quite some time waiting for the truck to arrive. Police helicopters, we know, were tracking the truck as it crossed across the state line to come into Oklahoma City. Some of the witnesses who saw these people downtown are particularly disturbed that if all they really wanted to do was bust some guys who were going to do a bombing, they could have arrested them at any time after they crossed the state line into Oklahoma. There was no reason in their minds to bring them into Oklahoma City. But they don't understand that it was absolutely necessary to the overall plan that the truck be in front of the building.
Because the bomb in the truck is not really what did the damage
right,
to the building.
The bomb in the truck is the cover-up for the internal explosions that were planned and planted. In front of the building prior to the bombing were seen, photographed, videotaped. I mean, the number of eyewitnesses is staggering. Bob Ricks was definitely there with that question. Luke Franey was there. Alex McCauley was there. Louis Free was also there.
Now, Louis Free, ladies and gentlemen, in case you're not acquainted with that name, is the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Louis Free says that he was not in Oklahoma City the morning of the bombing. We know absolutely that he was. We can prove that he was. Bob Ricks said that he was in Shawnee, Oklahoma, playing golf and was not there that morning. We know that he was there that morning. We can prove it. There are photographs that show Bob Ricks in the photographs there before the bomb exploded. Do you want to talk about the one that shows him with or not?
It exists. That's all I can say about it, is that it exists.
And
we want to tell them what exists.
Yes, let's tell them what exists.
What exists are more surveillance photographs. You see, this whole thing, just like the FBI always does, they love to keep records and record everything. In their minds, this was a big photo op to good publicity and promote whatever they wanted to promote, but they were keeping very good records of this entire event. And there are photographs in existence of Bob Ricks in front of the building, Bob Ricks with the Yellow Rider truck, and Bob Ricks speaking with John Doe, too, just minutes before the blast occurred. And it was at that time that my understanding from the witnesses is that
was actually talking to John Doe number 2 before the bomb went off. And John Doe number 2 was signaling to the FBI at the other end of the building that the bomb had not been deactivated.
Correct.
And this makes John Doe number 2, Bob Ricks, in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, guilty of conspiracy to bomb the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building.
Right. And the witnesses to all of these things...
And Bob Ricks is who?
Well, now he's head of the Department of Public Safety.
But who was he?
He was in charge of the FBI in Oklahoma City, and before that, he was the head honcho in charge of the FBI at Waco.
He is the man who was in charge when they murdered all of the people in that little church in Waco, Texas.
Right. The people who witnessed all of this, we are talking civilian and non-civilians, and they're understandably very upset their take on it is that if Terry Nichols is in jail for a little more than prior knowledge, they know about 2 dozen more people that ought to be in jail with him. And as we get closer to trial time for these 2 men accused, there are some people who cannot live with their secrets anymore. And since the publication of Oklahoma City Day 1, and they realize that these things that they knew in their hearts all this time are coming out and being exposed and documented, they're not quite as fearful as they were to come forward. And now they have someone that they can tell them to, and they know other books on the subject are following. And so the number of people coming out of the woodwork over the past 2 or 3 weeks has just been staggering.
Amazing. And more and more all the time. The amount of information and witnesses that are coming forward now just because of the publication of Oklahoma City Day 1 is way beyond what we imagined it would be. We knew that some would, and we were prepared for that, but we were not prepared for the tremendous number of people who are now coming forward to give testimony and evidence and documentation of what really happened. And what really happened, ladies and gentlemen, is absolutely nothing resembling what you've ever been told. Wow. We can also prove now, beyond any shadow of a doubt, ladies and gentlemen, because we are now in possession of photographs that show the actual damage inside of the building, damage that before we had proof. I mean, we had proof a long time ago that there were charges placed inside the building to bring that building down. Now we have so much proof that now it cannot even be argued that there were huge detonations inside the building that caused damage that the public has never been allowed to see. Would you like to talk about some of that?
Yeah, we now have acquired photographs from inside the building that show very large internal craters. And they're in the wrong place completely to have been done by any kind of outside truck bomb. When General Parton reviewed this information with the person from whom I got these photographs, he said that the street bomb, the truck bomb, would have had to have blown into the building, around the corner, and then down to make the huge, huge crater that goes down 2 stories below street level inside the building. We have photographs of those inside craters, the blow damage, blow pattern inside the building, and also photograph of the internal craters being filled.
We also have a photograph of holes in several walls, in consecutive walls, going from an explosion that directed its force from east to west, and could not have possibly been caused in any way, shape, or form by any explosion on the street, which couldn't have done any of the damage that was done, or very little of the damage that was done anyway. So let's go on from there.
Well, I'm not sure what more we can say about that. It was very interesting. For a while, there were media reports stating that there were no basements in the Mura Federal Building, and that the Social Security level was the ground level, and there was a little bit of underground parking and so forth, but there were 4 more floors underneath the Social Security office in the Mura Building. And there was a huge hole blown in the floor of the Social Security office down one floor level, and then a second huge hole blown into the floor below that in a different spot beneath the Social Security office. We now have the photographs of these, and they certainly were not caused by an ammonium nitrate fertilizer bomb out in the street.
So we know from these photographs, ladies and gentlemen, that the federal government had built a secret underground installation below the building that was indeed not on the plans and was not supposed to be there. And we know that an internal explosion inside the building blasted down into that underground installation several floors below the street level. And they're trying to... you know, this is exactly why they had to destroy that building, why they never let anyone of an independent outside investigative nature in there, and why they had to destroy that building, just like they had to destroy the evidence at Waco, Texas. As the fire burned, instead of trying to put it out, they sent in bulldozers and tanks to push all of the structure that had not yet burned into the fire to make sure that it was indeed burned. They then bulldozed it again, raised it, took out the bodies, and then just buried everything. It was, and put a fence around it with a quarantine sign. And essentially, that's what they did in Oklahoma City, isn't it?
Oh, that's exactly what they did in Oklahoma City. Only they moved the rubble about 15 miles away and buried it underground, and it's now behind a fence.
Which is also has signs that says quarantine.
Yeah, you can. another significant thing about those internal, those photographs taken inside the building, was that columns, vertical columns that remained standing, have nice smooth sheetrock or whatever's on the front of them on the north side. But when you look at the photographs photographing them from the back, they're pitted and damaged and beaten away and in terrible condition. And, of course, this had to have been caused by some damage from inside the building blowing outwardly. They weren't damaged from the north side at all.
In other words, the bomb going off in the vehicle on the street did no damage to the sheetrock on the columns inside the building. The damage to the sheetrock was done on the backside, caused by the explosions that occurred within the building that actually brought the building down.
Right, correct, correct.
Let me say this. We saw what you did, and we know who you are. And you're going down. You are going down. And if any of you are listening to this broadcast who are connected with it or know anything about it, you had better come out now to save your butts, because you're going down. And there's no doubt about it. None whatsoever. Am I right?
They got a chance to go public now, set their consciences straight, and tell the truth. And if they have to point fingers to their superiors, then so be it. But the people who know this information have to live the rest of their lives with what they know. And if they want to go to their graves always knowing in the back of their hearts that they did play a part in the death of 168 people and could have set things right when innocent men were being blamed and didn't, of course they'll be answerable to a celestial power in days to come, but it's not necessary that they live their lives with that secret. They can tell their stories anonymously. They can tell them on the public record. However they want the information released, it needs to be released. You're doing more damage than good by living with these secrets to yourselves, to your family, and to the rest of the American public.
Yes.
And I would just appeal to these guys to do what's right in your heart and tell the world what really happened and what you really know. And we will see to it that it is told.
And I've got to tell you this, if you were connected with it, and you don't help us solve this, you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. We're going to put you in prison. You're going down. And it's going to be the militia that does it. Let's go on to the next revelation that we had planned to discuss here.
I'm trying to think what more we talked about. Again, we covered a lot of material. We can talk about this report.
Okay. Let me prepare you for what you're going to hear. We have in our possession a report made by an official investigator of the Oklahoma City Police Department. It is a long report. It is right exactly to the point. It agrees with what we have discovered in our investigation. It is a report that was given by the Oklahoma City Police Department to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And we're not going to read you the entire report because it would take an awful long time, but Michelle is going to read some specific excerpts, and at some later date we will most likely publish the entire report so that it will be available to the public, probably in the appendix of either the next volume of our Oklahoma City series or volume 3, one of the two.
All right, I'm going to skip the introduction and go directly to page 2, and I'm just going to skip around and read you some little parts, and if you have comments you want to make about this as we go, just jump in there.
Oh, you know me, I'll do that.
No doubt. Okay, quoting now. It rapidly became obvious that the media was being directed and was not reporting impartially. When independent investigators began to trace the origins of the media, and henceforth the government, focus on the right wing, and especially constitutionalist paramilitary groups and so-called militia organizations, what was discovered was self-explanatory. The so-called experts in the field of tracking hate groups that were feeding the media centered on two organizations, the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, of the B'nai B'rith, described by other Jewish organizations as extremely left-wing, and the very liberal Southern Poverty Law Center, who has reportedly been connected to the Communist Party of the USA, CPUSA. It began to become apparent that these two organizations were using the event in Oklahoma City to their own ends and to further their own agenda. Evidence of this became apparent as certain liberal politicians began a massive onslaught through the media against various military, paramilitary groups, so-called militias, hate groups, and often conservative, religious, and constitutionalist groups in general, including the National Rifle Association, who one reporter attempted to link directly to the bombing by being financially involved. Do you want to comment on any of that?
No, but it's exactly what we discovered happened in Waco. We found out that the initial focus upon the Branch Davidian Church was brought to bear by elements of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, in particular in Australia. And this is on record. The Anti-Defamation people themselves have admitted these things, and that the most of the information given to or directed to the press for reporting to the American people was managed and handled and directed to the press by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith and the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in this investigation, in this report, it's the first indication that we know that law enforcement within the United States definitely, without a doubt, connects the Southern Poverty Law Center and Morris Dees directly to the Communist Party of the U.S., of the United States of America.
Right, and they turned this report into the FBI. So it's no big secret, although they're trying to pretend that it is.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. Discrepancies began to develop in the official version of the scenario, and within weeks the matter became extremely controversial in non-mainstream media such as the internet, newsletters, independent radio shows, shortwave broadcasts, independent newspapers, and other forms of media not tied to the major networks in New York or Los Angeles. It was at this point that this writer began attempting to assemble the pieces of the puzzle into a logical pattern. Only by taking all of the information available, filtering out what definitely does not belong, then piecing the mosaic together can one draw a picture, albeit incomplete, of what may have happened. The remainder of this document is written utilizing myriad sources, some of unknown reliability, but many extremely reliable, and contacts both within and without government circles at local, state, and the federal level.
Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, she's still reading from this report made by an official investigator for the Oklahoma City Police Department, and this report was put on file with the Oklahoma City PD and was given to the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yes. Continuing to quote, assuming there was a conspiracy involved and that McVeigh and Nichols could not physically by themselves do all that had to be done in the time constraints of their activities from the time of the truck rental to the time of the explosion, there would have to be others involved. It would appear from the information presented on the following pages that McVeigh and Nichols may be only two members of a field team, compartmentalized and organized in structured level. If this is the case, and the following information is even partially correct, the investigation is far from over, and it goes much higher than McVeigh and Nichols.
And that's exactly what we've known from the very beginning. And we know a lot more than he does.
Well, he's right on a lot of things.
He's right on. Yes, he is.
I'm still quoting the report. Investigatory techniques used in this investigation. What follows is an investigative report to date. And by the way, this was dated the 29th of September, 96. Utilizing the standards of 1, follow the money. 2, follow the power. 3, follow the players. 4, look for linkages, consistencies, patterns, and coincidences, even those that appear remote, and discrepancies that obviously create problems with the final synopsis. 5, look for an attempt to establish a motive. 6, determine who had the means to plan, conduct, and execute the crime, then have the power to possibly influence the resultant investigation. And 7, observe the outcome of the investigation. Was it complete? Did it answer all the questions? I think, as we know from where we're at right now with the investigation, as far as the prosecution is concerned, not only have they not answered 99% of the existing questions, they're not even in the ballpark. They're not even touching on the issues that really matter in this thing.
No, but the prosecution is not interested in that. They're interested in furthering the socialist agenda, which this whole thing was promulgated to do, and they don't want anything to interfere with the conviction of Nichols and McVeigh, which might lead into the true perpetrators and the true agenda that was furthered by the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
This section of the report is entitled The Scene, and I won't read all of the things listed here, but there are some items of great interest. It says, shortly after the explosion in Oklahoma City, several events occurred almost simultaneously. 1, as emergency services responded, 2 other bombs were discovered by investigators and the bomb technicians responded. The first bomb was discovered within minutes after the explosion as emergency workers began searching the interior of the building for victims and survivors, and the second within 20 minutes of the first. 1 was deactivated on site. The status of the second device was not broadcast over television. Both were described as military canisters or devices. Later explanation would be that these were training devices left about by the ATF. This explanation did not satisfactorily explain why they were in different spots in the building far from the ATF offices located on the top floor.
We know that they were placed near the elevator shaft, that they were military canisters of fulminate of mercury with mil-spec numbers. We know that they had the detonators placed through holes in the top of these canisters that were, according to witnesses, set to go off 10 minutes after the first explosion, but for some reason they did not detonate. You want to add anything to that?
No, I'll move on.
Okay.
Next item. Within 3 hours, a fireman on the third floor of the building noted 2 military box ambulances, unmarked, back up near the building, and saw several men in black or dark fatigues carrying stretchers out to the ambulances from the lower floor or basement of the building. Many of the stretchers had boxes, which appeared to contain papers or documents, and one had what were described as, quote, some type of shoulder-fired missiles or missile tubes. Close quote. Now, I know from talking to rescuers on the scene that the work on the south side of the building was stopped completely for approximately 6 hours while documents and things were removed. That did happen.
Mm-hmm.
Next item, many witnesses, I'm quoting again, many witnesses stated that they heard two distinct explosions, the second more powerful than the first. To back this up, two seismograms, which recorded the event, showed two distinct markings approximately 10 seconds apart from two separate locations. A later explanation for this would be that the first event was the initial explosion and the second was the building collapsing. Later charts, recorded when the building was demolished, refuted this, however. The remainder of the building, much larger than the destroyed section, made almost no marks on the graph when it fell. Another item of interest, some witnesses described seeing a dark-colored, unmarked helicopter leaving the rooftop of the building a few minutes before the explosion. Oklahoma City Police Department's two McDonnell Douglas helicopters, black and silver in color, were on the ground at their base at this time. They did not respond until after the explosion. The origin of this helicopter is unknown, nor are there indications that this lead was followed up on. And I would just remark that I have two eyewitnesses who both reported independently of each other seeing this black unmarked helicopter above the building.
Now, we had that as a rumor on the first day and discussed it on the radio broadcast.
Right. It's been confirmed.
And it has now been absolutely confirmed that there was a black helicopter in the vicinity or leaving the roof of the building after or prior to, was it prior to?
The one witness I talked to said that she saw it within 5 seconds after the blast.
Okay.
And that's consistent with the other stories that I've heard about it. Above the building, leaving 5 seconds. So, all right. Next item. Other conflicts arose by the hour as other discrepancies occurred. As federal authorities switched tracks from Islamics to right-wing radicals and began to trace McVeigh's movements and associates, outside organizations enter the picture and begin to point fingers at political rivals and enemies. The Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center immediately began feeding New York City-based media organizations, including the major news networks, quote, information, close quote, identifying various right-wing groups as hate groups capable of inflaming such activities and indeed possibly linked to the occurrence. Both organizations take every opportunity to lump conservative organizations into the same group, from the White Aryan Resistance to the Christian Coalition and the KKK to the NRA. As each news program and news magazine interview transpires, the public begins to notice more and more that the dialogue appears to be orchestrated and that political agendas are being served, but only on the left wing. This makes many people suspect that the, quote, government, close quote, is more involved in the bombing than the media is willing to expose. The problem at this point for the observer is the definition of government. Anyone who suspects involvement by any governmental agent or agency, whether directly involved or involved by omission or failure to properly perform an investigation, becomes debunked as a conspiracy theorist. The problem with this, like lumping all right-wing groups together, is that a conspiracy in this case does exist, with only the extent not known. Therefore, there is no theory. The issue then becomes this, exactly who is involved and why. To answer this and other questions, the search must follow the previously linked tenets of a proper investigation. To follow the money, the power, and the players requires a great deal of research into past political events wherein the same names seem to appear, linking events. Though some of what follows does not appear at first to relate to the Oklahoma City bombing, the reader must keep the information in mind as this report progresses to gain a full understanding of the ramifications and possibilities of the event. For this, the timeline begins in the 1980s.
We've got to take a break here, and we've got to do a few things here, ladies and gentlemen, so don't go away. To all of our affiliate FM stations across the nation and around the world, we are going to continue this broadcast. If you would like to keep it on your particular affiliate station, you may do so. If not, then go back to your regular programming, but I got to tell you, you're going to miss a lot. And if you normally carry the Quest for Help with Michael Cottingham at this time, Michael Cottingham and his broadcast Quest for Help will be aired immediately following the completion of the extended period of the Hour of the Time. This is the Voice of Freedom. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. We now return you to the Hour of the Time extended version. Welcome back to the extended version, ladies and gentlemen, of the Hour of the Time tonight. We're going to go as long as it takes to cover all of this material. And we're doing this for a reason. Number one, the American public needs to know. Number two, we know that if you try to keep things secret, people disappear. If they know that we have this information and that it has been copied hundreds of times and disseminated into the trusted hands of the officers of the intelligence service, then they're not so likely to hurt people in order to stop it reaching the public. At this point, there is no way that they can stop anything that we have from reaching the American public, and there is no way that these people who are involved in the Oklahoma Mura federal building from the lowest to the highest level are going to escape answering for what they did and taking responsibility for what they did. They're going down. If you're involved, if you're listening to this broadcast and you're involved in any way, if you're not involved and you know something and you're keeping it to yourself, you had better come out with it now. Because I got to tell you, the law says that if you don't, you are guilty, just as guilty as the one who lit the fuse. And we're going to take them down. There is no way, ladies and gentlemen, that they're going to escape prison for what they've done. And it's going to reach into the highest levels of government, I can assure you. I'm not talking about the government did this. I'm talking about socialist and communist agents within the government of the United States of America who instigated the bombing of the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building to fulfill